Sony has become the world's biggest music publisher after signing a deal to gain control of publishing giant EMI. This means the Japanese titan now has a catalog of over 2 million tracks from artists such as Beyoncé, Kanye West, Alicia Keys, and Calvin Harris. The $2.3 billion deal is part of new CEO Kenichiro Yoshida's mission to revamp Sony. He only took over in April, and he's trying to shift the company's main focus away from low-margin consumer electronics.
There's a dilemma on industrial factory floors across America, like the ones operated by Caterpillar and its suppliers. Demand is booming for Caterpillar's heavy-duty earth-moving equipment that's sold all over the world. And that means they're staying away from the carefree spending spree President Donald Trump was hoping for with his $1.5 trillion tax cut. It's creating a supply chain problem. There's another issue, a super tight labor market.
American novelist Philip Roth has died at the age of 85. Roth's agent said that he died of congestive heart failure in New York City on Tuesday night. Roth penned more than 30 books in a career spanning more than 50 years. He received both praise and criticism for his portrayal of the Jewish American experience. In 2010, he was awarded the National Humanities Medal by then-President Barack Obama. In 1997, Roth won the Pulitzer Prize for American Pastoral, which examined the impact of the 1960s on a New Jersey family.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's May 24th, and it's 5:11 in the morning. Can you feel it? Three-day weekend is getting a little bit closer. I can feel it just a little bit. Thanks for being here with us this morning on The Opening Bell, and another business day getting underway on the broadcast today. A little bit later in the program, at about 5:40, the boating industry in the U.S. is preparing for a busy summer season. We will talk about how sales are climbing for boating enthusiasts. Lots of folks apparently are buying boats. That'll be in our second segment again this morning. And it's Thought Leader Thursday here on The Opening Bell. Wayne Janis is here from the financial planning practice at Whitnell, the affiliate of Associated Bank. And we'll bring in Wayne just momentarily to begin our Thursday conversation. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, shares have been mixed in Asia today after the Trump administration says it was said it would be investigating imposing new tariffs on imports of autos and auto parts. Fresh trade tensions combined with uncertainties over the North Korean situation grabbed attention in the absence of other market-moving developments. In this country, futures are relatively flat, barely moving on the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P. The rest of Asia, markets in China are a little bit higher. And in Japan, again, the market's going to end the day down about 1%, down about 252 points. In Europe, markets are generally higher, but not by a lot, just about 0.25% to 0.5% in Germany, France, and in London. A couple of stories we're watching for you this morning is, of course, the trade issue. Just when we thought the water was nice to go back into, the Trump administration has thrown another wrench into trade talks, and China, reacting to that this morning, says it'll firmly defend its rights and interests against what it calls the Trump administration's abuse of national security provisions in trade, mentioning the investigation of whether the U.S. needs to impose tariffs on auto imports. And Kroger is looking to take a big bite out of the online grocery market. It's buying Chicago-based meal kit seller Home Chef for about $200 million. The company may pay an additional $500 million over 5 years if sales reach certain milestones. Kroger plans to put Home Chef kits in its supermarkets. Kroger, by the way, the parent company of Mariano's in the Chicago area. It is Thought Leader Thursday. Wayne Janis is here. He's the president of financial planning, financial practice at Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. This morning's conversation is going to focus on finding the right financial advisor and other topics. Wayne, good morning. Welcome back to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. We want to do a kind of a deep dive today on financial and tax advisors. And since you're the expert, we want to figure out what's right for us, what are the definitions, what are the titles, what we can expect. So why don't we begin with just a very basic question about financial and tax advisors. What are they? How are they different? How are they the same?
Financial and tax advisor, there's a two different things. Financial advisor is one, tax advisor is something else. But if you're talking about a firms that have people that are both, like I consider myself both. I'm a CPA with a master's in tax degree, and I also give financial planning advice. But a financial planner is schooled in the kind of the criteria of being a certified financial planner. What do they do? They help people to navigate their way through all of the financial issues as they move through life. When they're graduating college and they get jobs and they need help, when they get married, they have children, what do? I mean, what kind of insurance should they have? And as they go through life, they go marriage, the difficulties, should you have a prenuptial agreement? Should I marry a person that's got a $300,000 student loan? How's that going to affect my ability to ever own a house? Have changes of jobs? And what does it mean? Mm-hmm. People, oftentimes when they change jobs, don't realize what they've given up. Because if they have a pension plan and they give up vesting, or they have stock options or things where their current employer is, they don't tend to count anything but cash compensation. So it's helpful if you get somebody that understands these things and tells them, here's the real cost of leaving. Yes, you're going to get a 10% increase in your W-2, but you're missing out on a lot of perks that you're getting, tax-free perks that you're getting where you're at now. And as you move through, I mean, if you stay with the financial advisor long enough, they're going to help you through life, through planning for educating your kids. Should we use a 529 plan? Should we use custodial accounts? They'll help you through planning for retirement. I mean, oftentimes people say, how much do I need to have in my bucket to retire?
Yeah.
How much will I need? And then you when you talk about that, they'd say, well, it depends on what you plan to do when you retire. If your lifestyle is as it is now and you don't want to change what you're spending now, then you need to have an amount of money that'll get you to that number plus cover the inflation. So you have to plan to do it. And you don't start doing retirement planning when you're 55. You start that early on, because what you can do, how you save money in your earlier years, has a big impact on the success ratio of being able to retire in a comfortable way. It deals with risk. Advisors help them deal with risk. Should I have an umbrella insurance? Should I have liability insurance? I'm in a high-risk business. I'm a baby doctor. What would I do to mitigate the risk to myself and my family? Insurance, or is there different ways to invest money or incorporate myself? What are the things that I need to do to mitigate the high risk that I have in my life generally? So I think it runs the gamut from young people that are getting started to retirement, and then even planning the estate. And one of the things that's probably the most difficult for people to cope with, because they're going through trauma, is when their spouse dies. And all these complicated things they have to deal with, probate, and have to deal with trust, and have to deal with all of these issues at a time when they don't want to think about it. They just lost a spouse of 50 years, and they don't want to think about what to do. And so they really need a lot of help then to just get through that in a way that would protect them for the future.
And so it sounds to me like if you're lucky enough in your younger years to find a guy or a gal who knows all of what you've just talked about, you could almost have that person through your whole life as your advisor.
Well, it's not uncommon for people to do that. In fact, there was an article I read this past week about the best financial advisors are those that have a proprietary interest in their clients. They stay connected, and if you think about, they understand the family. They know how they feel about the kids and not spoiling the kids, or how to help the kids, and they become proprietary. And because of that, their clients are also their best. They're marketers, because good advisors that do a good job for their clients get referrals from those clients. They send them to their family, they send them to their friends, and so they talk them up. And so it is a long-term. If you have a successful relationship, it is long-term.
So when I go to meet a potential financial advisor, what things should I look for? Obviously, if I'm meeting you, you seem very nice and very knowledgeable, but that's only on the surface. What kinds of questions should I ask you so that I know that I'm getting the right kind of advisor?
Well, I think the starting point is how you got to me in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't pick me out of the Yellow Pages, and so somewhere you got a referral. You either heard me speaking on WGN, or you got a referral from a family member and a friend who has said, like, I've worked with Wayne for the last 10 years. He knows me. He knows how to help me solve my problems. I'm comfortable. He's helping me make the right decisions. But you don't stop there. Then you check them out, and the NASD and the SEC publish reports about advisors, and if they've been sued for doing bad things, or if they've been hit by the SEC for doing things that are bad. If they're really bad, they don't let you serve clients anymore. But there's plenty of information about complaints that have been issued against financial advisors and other material about what they've done in the published media that you can get online from the SEC website or the NASD website to track down these people and hear, see what their reputation is, at least knowing that they weren't ever accused of wrongdoing.
It sounds to me like there's a little bit of homework you have to do, but the referral should be the starting point always.
Yes, I think that there's so many people out there, and the skill sets, there's no one rule that says in order to be a financial advisor, you have to do this, or this is the service you have to provide. There's differences in some planning firms. They even go so far as we do. We prepare tax returns. We help people with estate planning. We help them with their investments. We help them with their estate plans, how to set up charitable foundations, how to set up charitable accounts. So the level of service varies from firm to firm, and the expertise and the experience of the people within those firms.
Here's the million-dollar question for you, and that is, what's the level of income that we would see for getting a financial advisor? Is it somebody that has $1 million? Is it somebody who just has a little bit of money? What are the different levels there for looking for a financial advisor?
Well, obviously, the very wealthy people need advisors. I mean, my own experience with coming out of Big Eight Accounting, where I worked with presidents of companies, and you see all the complications that they have, and they're so busy in their professional lives, they have very little time to figure out how to get through all these things. So the very wealthy need that help. Having said that, a couple of years back, I was referred by a client to a friend of his who was working with one of the big brokerage houses, and he was unhappy with his results and wanted to talk to me, and then asked what I would charge him. And I looked at his position. I said, 0.5% a year on your assets. And mm-hmm. He said, well, that's a lot of money. And I said, I went through his portfolio and what he paid to his advisor, and I said, do you know what you paid them last year? He said, I think I paid him $50,000. You're a little bit off. You paid him $1 million.
Wow.
You paid them, and this was not a billionaire. This guy had $30 million. So he paid over 3% of his portfolio. He said, you're kidding. I said, look, you got these hidden fees here. You got these expenses here. You got insurance loads here. You got all these. All of the fees are buried inside. And so, yeah, you're a guy with $30 million, but you paid $1 million. And what you're saying, it'll take you 10 years to pay me, based on my fee, what you paid him in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do planning. He didn't do tax planning. He's not going to help you with your prenuptial agreement. He's not going to help you with how to deal with trusts. And so on the wealthy side, even they, it's interesting how many, you go to maybe a big firm, and you sometimes you get the right person, sometimes you don't. It's always good to have a second opinion, find out whether you're overpaying. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes down to other people, that great example I have, because it was a friend of mine, and his mother came to me, and she had some problems and wanted to look at things, and she lost her husband. She was in her 80s, early 80s, and she lost her husband. He had done a great job managing their life savings. because she just had Social Security and a tiny pension. But he had accumulated about $500,000 over many years investing in mutual funds. Well, he died. And he happened to die during the financial crisis when the $500,000 dropped to $400,000. So she was scared, went to a so-called financial planner who sold all those mutual funds at the bottom of the market and put her into an annuity contract, all the money that locked her into a 2.5% a year return for the next 10 years for somebody that's 80.
Right.
And so with a 10-year surrender charge and a $20,000 commission, she could have gotten great financial advice for $5,000,
yeah.
Independent. And what would have happened if she had left that money in those funds? Yeah, she paid a $20,000 fee locked into a 10-year surrender charge. If she kept her husband's mutual funds, today they're worth $1.6 million. They went from $400,000 to $1.6 million. Her $400,000 is now $450,000 because it got locked into high costs, low returns, and surrender charges. So just about everybody goes through stages in their life when they need help. And they need to, a young couple getting started, having a family, trying to decide what's the best thing to do. And yeah, you can go and spend a few $1,000s and get some good advice from a planner. But you go in, you get insurance because you know you got kids now, yeah. And you got a wife that decided to stay home, and you got to protect all of them. So you go out to get insurance. And if you end up getting sold whole life insurance and you end up with $250,000 of insurance and the broker made thousands of dollars of commissions, you missed the boat. You didn't protect the family with $250,000 of insurance. You should have gotten a term insurance policy from an organization that charges no commission on it and got $1 million for a few hundred dollars a year. That protects your family. So when you ask that question, you look at this. Well, these people can't afford thousands of dollars in fees to a planner. Then I'd say, well, as to the widow, it cost her $20,000 in commissions to lose $1.2 million in growth. As far as the family, they need, if he died and they got $250,000 of insurance instead of $1 million, how well protected was the family? They're covering maybe 2 or 3 years of his income, period. They're going to be in big trouble because they didn't get enough insurance because they didn't get good advice. They didn't get unbiased advice.
Yeah. And that's the next question. How we all would expect that, right? The unbiased advice. Are you expected to give that to me, or is there any? What rules are in place to make sure that happens?
In my structure and my format, we are fiduciaries. We are bound morally and legally to give the best advice to our clients. And so, you owe it to your clients. What do you owe to your clients? Honesty. It doesn't mean that a commission-based person that's a planner can't do a good job. But if you're selling something as opposed to giving advice, disclosure is critical. If you say to somebody, if somebody is recommending something to you, an insurance product or an annuity or a mutual fund, the appropriate question everyone should ask that person is, what do you get paid if I buy this? If they tell you, well, if you buy that insurance contract, I'm going to make a $15,000 commission, it's a, well, let me think about that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you read the small print in the insurance contract, it's there. It has been disclosed legally.
Yeah.
But I think for people to understand, they need to ask that question. Don't be embarrassed about it, because it's good to know whether you're getting advice or being sold a product. Because the bulk of the transactions that happen are sales transactions, not advisory relationship answers. They're not geared towards giving the best advice necessarily. But if you're a broker and you can sell the green one and make 4% and sell the blue one and make 10%, you're a broker. Even if you're a certified financial planner, yeah. You have a license to sell products. And that's how you and a good way to check that is with the reporting that every firm has to do with the SEC, because it'll spell out how much money people make, and it'll say the revenue of the firm is this, 90% of it comes from commissions, and only 10% comes from fees. Well, then you know this organization is highly oriented towards being a sales organization, not an advisory. If you read another one, it says 100% of the fees are advisory and there are no commissions. Well, then you know, you've got a better view of whether they're not selling anything. Yeah. But there are people, I don't want to say that all salespeople are bad. They're not. There are a lot of great ones out there, and they sell the appropriate products. But there's a danger there because there's a motivation to sell things that generate more income to the seller.
I'm hearing you say that this process of hiring a financial advisor is really like an investment. Treat it like an investment. Should I treat it like an investment?
Yes. Well, it's your future. The mistakes you make could be very expensive if you don't get the right kind of advice. Now, there's plenty of literature and looking into things and getting information on the websites and learning about the right things to do. But it's so complicated when you're dealing with benefits from the company where you work, how to structure your wills, what kind of powers of attorney do you give, who takes care of your kids if you and your wife would go down on a 747, how are they going to be protected? There's a lot of things that maybe don't give you an immediate payback, but they make they make your family safer because you made good decisions and you put strong things in place to make sure that your family will be cared for after you're gone.
Wayne, good information. We'll send people to you at Associated Bank. How's that sound?
It's a good thing. We believe in what we do. We think that we put the client's interest first. And I do know that if you do that, you do make your clients a referral source. They send you their family and their friends, and you get your business grows because your reputation grows as being somebody that cares about the client first.
We'll see you next time.
Okay.
Wayne Janis is the president of financial planning practice at Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. It's our thought leader conversation. We're going to continue talking with Wayne after the bell and post that in the podcast of the broadcast later this morning at WGNradio.com. And remember, you can find more information about our thought leaders and past conversations, too, at AssociatedBank.com/thought leadership.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Chicago startup Reverb, an online marketplace for buying and selling music gear, announced it has added 10,000 additional square feet to its office in Roscoe Village, equipped with a new video production space, recording studio, and green room for artists. Reverb now has 170 employees and is on pace to do $42 million in revenue. Autism in Motion Clinics, a startup that aims to provide autism therapy to children in rural communities throughout the U.S., won first place and $45,000 at the University of Chicago Social New Venture Challenge, a venture competition at UChicago that awards startups with a social mission. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of the opening bell. With the boating season about to get underway in earnest here in the Chicago area with Memorial Day, the boating industry is preparing for a busy summer, not just with people on their boats, but people buying them as well. Tom Domrick is with us this morning. He's the president of the National Marine Manufacturers Association. Tom, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning, Steve. Glad to be with you.
And talk to us about the numbers. I'm guessing the good economy has something to do with this.
Yes, the good economy has a lot to do with it. Last year we saw sales of new powerboats increase 5%, reaching a 10-year high. And total spending by Americans on recreational boating last year also reached an all-time high of $39 billion. And the boating industry and American spending on boating is growing more than twice as fast as the U.S. economy is. But clearly, strong GDP, strong consumer confidence are good for the recreational boating industry.
Is this geographical? Are there places in the country where it's better than others?
Well, the strongest boating states tend to be the coastal states, which includes the Great Lakes states. But it's doing well across all segments of the industry and across all parts of the country right now.
You mentioned the powerboats in there. That's the biggest. For those of us who are locked on land and don't do much boating, what would that entail? I'm guessing it would just be the powerboats that come to mind when you say that word.
Well, powerboats would include everything from personal watercraft, ski and wakeboard boats, pontoon boats, saltwater fishing boats, ski and wakeboard boats, freshwater fishing boats. So it's quite a variety. And the strongest segment right now is the ski and wakeboard boats and the pontoon boats, which are both growing at about 8% annually.
Give us a sense of what the trends are in boating. When somebody does come and get one of these, let's say a pontoon boat, what are they putting on it, and what kinds of things are they buying with it?
So one of the biggest trends is toward outboard boats, outboard power on boats. Today, about 85% of all boats sold are powered with outboard engines. And the trend is toward a day boat. People are looking for a very versatile boat that they can go out for the day and do lots of different things. If they could water ski or pull a tuber on, they could fish from, they can swim from, or they can just relax and enjoy the great outdoors.
Tom, talk to us a little bit about the manufacturers in this space. Who are the big players, and where are they located, and what are their strengths?
So the largest manufacturers would include companies like Brunswick, Tracker, Bennington, Chaparral Boats, and they cross all segments of the industry. What we're seeing, though, with the strong demand that the industry has experienced is that a lot of boat and engine manufacturers are expanding capacity to meet that demand.
I am always surprised to see about the new developments in safety and how the boats are being built these days. It's really not your father's boat, is it?
No, it's not. There are so many more amenities on boats today than there used to be. It's not unlike the automobile industry. Today's consumer is demanding lots of toys on the boat. So you've got lots of electronics, from sophisticated sound systems and televisions to fish finders and GPS. There are new innovations like joystick docking, where a kid could dock a boat using a joystick. But there's lots of innovations, new shade methods to provide shade on boats, and seats that you can create new seating with the push of a button. So there's just so many new things. And frankly, it's the innovations and the new product that sells new boats and creates demand for new boats.
I've always been told by economics professors that you can always tell the health of the economy. One of the industries is the boating industry, by whether people are buying boats or not. And people might have the misconception that this is sort of a wealthy person's game, that it's the wealthy that are buying boats, but that's from a demographics point not what you know.
No, that's true. In fact, you drive down Lakeshore Drive and you see the marinas and you see all the big boats, but 95% of all boats sold each year and in use in the U.S. are smaller than 26 feet. They're basically trailerable boats, and 62% of boat owners have a household income of less than $100,000 a year. So it is predominantly middle class, maybe a little upper middle class pastime.
And I know we've been talking about the purchase of new boats and marine equipment, but part of the story here is the sale of pre-owned stuff too, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, sale of pre-owned boats reached a high point in 2017 as well. If we take new boat sales and pre-owned sales, about 1.25 million boats were sold in 2017. And we're seeing that same trend continue in 2018.
Well, here in the Midwest, we are looking forward to our first summer weekend here. Any closing words about boats and boat safety?
Well, We always believe that the most enjoyable boating experience is a safe boating experience. Very important that who's ever driving the boat is not drinking while they're driving. Being out on the water and in the sunshine accentuates the effects of alcohol. So if you're driving a boat, stay away from the alcohol. And if you're underway, it doesn't hurt to have your life vest on. So boating safety makes for a much more enjoyable experience.
Tom, we appreciate you being with us here this morning. Have a good boating season.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
Tom Domerick is the president of the National Marine Manufacturers Association. We're going to post some more information on finding the NMMA and more on this story in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later this morning at WGNradio.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures off about 12 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are flat. Now agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, some activity in the Chinese market yesterday. First of all, soybean futures went to a 2.5-week high. Signs of renewed Chinese demand for U.S. exports lifted prices for a fourth straight session. And indeed, the Chinese were in the U.S. soybean market yesterday. A Chinese importer purchased one cargo of U.S. soybeans for August shipment from the Pacific Northwest. The purchase by a privately held firm marked the first scale of U.S. or the first sale of U.S. soybeans to China, the world's largest soybean importer. So at the end of the day, the soybean market showing pretty good gains with the July contract up 8.25 cents, but July wheat did actually better, up 10 cents a bushel, and July corn ended 3.5 cents higher. Turning to the livestock market yesterday, some investment fund buying apparently brought livestock futures higher. Lean hogs bouncing from yesterday's roughly 3-week low. It happened because of technical and investment fund buying. At the end of the day, the May feeder cattle contract up 95 cents a hundredweight. The July lean hog contract up 92 cents. And the June live cattle contract up 52 cents for the day. Some more challenging news for dairy companies, Dean Foods in particular. Hundreds of employees will lose their jobs when a well-known Massachusetts dairy company shuts the doors to its Lynn, Massachusetts factory. But started 80 years ago by a family, now owned by Dean Foods, shutting down because of a nationwide decrease in milk consumption. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, May 24th, Freddie Mac issues its report on weekly average mortgage rates. The National Association of Realtors has sales of existing homes. We'll also get the weekly jobless claims, the EIA natural gas report, the FHFA house price index, and a couple of Fed speakers out there as well. We'll get a report on the Fed balance sheet and money supply and in earnings. Best Buy and Gap will report earnings, quarterly financial earnings. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday, May 24th.